So thank you all for coming this evening, and thank the organizers for inviting me and all the volunteers. I don't know of any Dharma organization that I've ever been involved with that doesn't need more volunteers, more helping hands. So I really appreciate all your efforts to help carry the Dharma forward another week. And just think, it's been going on like that for 2,600 years. Not bad. So we're just the current stewards of the Dharma being carried forward from the past into the future. And without us doing the work that we do, volunteers doing your work, me doing my work, and you all doing your work, there are untold generations of children, men and women, that are going to be born that are going to want to hear this Dharma like we hear it, and to have the opportunity to disentangle their hearts and minds from suffering and the causes of suffering too. So if each one of us does our part as much as we can to hear the Dharma, to understand the Dharma, to practice the Dharma, to realize the Dharma, to share the Dharma, to live the Dharma, then for a long time it'll be available to us and others. So thank you all very much. So as I was being requested to supply a topic and content for the talk this evening, and this was a month or so ago or two, I can't quite remember, there were a few things going through my mind, a few reflections, and I want to share them because they're the seeds out of which this talk this evening has sprouted. I read an article that was written some years ago about a Vipassana teachers meeting that I had attended at Spirit Rock 22 years ago. And at that time there were 30 teachers there, and someone had the audacity to ask how many of us considered ourselves Theravada Buddhist, meaning Buddhist that practice in the tradition from Thailand, Burma, or Sri Lanka. And out of the 30, I was one of the three people who raised their hand. That was a surprise to me. I thought everybody at Spirit Rock would be kind of coming from that tradition, but not so. And then I was remembering another Vipassana, international Vipassana teachers meeting that took place at Spirit Rock just 2 years ago, 20 years later. And one whole day of this teachers conference was devoted to the secular applications of mindfulness. Now, you know, mindfulness is all the rage these days. It has hit the big time, Time magazine, actually. And by the time anything hits Time magazine, it's passé. But anyway, nevertheless, you know, if you haven't gotten on that train, it's too late. So, but nevertheless, we had a day-long discussion on all of these applications of mindfulness in medical and therapeutic and social situations, and the value of that for so many people to hear it de-Buddhicized, if you will, or with the Dharma taking out and just having kind of a practical, pragmatic application of mindfulness. So it was a long discussion because there's a lot of people who are offering mindfulness of one sort or another, and some of the teachers there were also offering mindfulness in a secular context or in corporations and things like that. And so at the end of the day, there was a circle of all of us, 60 or 70 of us, to go around in the circle to just to share briefly what their takeaway from the day's discussion of secular Dharma was all about, what their takeaway was. And so I listened to the takeaways as it was going around the circle, and there was a lot of concern that those who are offering mindfulness should be qualified, should have a full understanding of the Dharma, should be recognized by some authorities as being of offering the authentic mindfulness from the Theravada tradition. And there was a lot of concern that the mindfulness of the Dharma, mindfulness might be slipping the grip of authentic Buddhists and just being kind of McMindfulnessed. And so there was a lot of concern among the group. And when it got to me to offer a my takeaway from the day, I said something like, you know, if we've got 1,000 people sharing or teaching mindfulness-based stress reduction or mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for relapse prevention of depression or mindfulness-based addiction, addressing addictions of one sort or another, or any of the many other medical and therapeutic ways that mindfulness is being used. I said, if we've got 1,000 people teaching hundreds of thousands of people to practice basic mindfulness, what an opportunity we have. The basic work's been done. Now it's up to us as those who may be carrying more of the Dharma than just mindfulness to pick them up, to carry them forward with MBSR 2.0. And I don't mean mindfulness-based stress reduction 2.0, I mean mindfulness-based sanity revealed, mindfulness-based spiritual renewance, mindfulness-based staying real, mindfulness-based social responsibility, mindfulness-based simple reality. Fill in the blanks. There's infinite possibilities for applying mindfulness in our life outside of a strictly Buddhist or Theravada or context. And I think that all of us are doing that in our own way, and there's a lot of opportunity. And then I remembered another thought that was going through my mind at the time was that the Buddha's teaching in its most simplest form is said to be to do good, to avoid causing harm, and to develop the mind. And to develop the mind in this case means to develop the mind through the tranquility that comes from mindfulness, but also the wisdom that comes through vipassana insight. So to develop the mind is not only mindfulness, it also involves the development of the mind through practicing vipassana or insight meditation. Then one last reflection that helped me frame the topic tonight was, I wondered why Nibbana is so rarely mentioned by Western Dharma teachers. And I might just ask you to consider, when was the last time you heard your Dharma teacher talk about Nibbana? So, as I reflected on the applications of mindfulness in our secular applications of mindfulness, or let's say mindfulness outside of the Buddhist context, I considered, well, what's missing? Or what's the problem? Or why isn't, or why don't those who practice, let's say, secular mindfulness, why don't they move on through or move on into the additional teachings of the Buddha? You don't have to call them the teachings of the Buddha. You can call them the teachings of secular layperson. But there still is a lot of wisdom there to be gained. And so the thought that came to my mind, or the understanding that came to my mind, was that there is not the map. There's not the understanding that mindfulness can be used in these other ways. That mindfulness is not only beneficial in treating depression and other psychological or stressful conditions, but it can actually treat ordinary mundane life conditions. You know, it doesn't have to be just pathological application. And so I thought, well, what's missing is an understanding that this is possible. So this is called right view. In the Buddhist teachings of the Noble Eightfold Path, the teachings on right view, or skillful views, skillful way of understanding experience, is the forerunner for our interest and faith and actual application of energy to fulfill Dharma practices. You know, when we grow up in our families and in our cultures, we learn from our parents, we learn from our peers, we learn from our culture, we learn from our religion of birth, we learn from our government, we learn at school how to understand, how to believe, what to believe, what not to believe, and how to view the world, how to view ourselves in the world, how to view the purpose of life. And we've been taught this by, as you know, you can count the people in your personal history that have supplied you some of these understandings. That's their view. That's their understanding. That's their, based on their assumptions of the way life is for us as a human being. But I want to suggest that those views, those beliefs, those understandings come with all of the baggage of personal history, cultural history, psychological history, and they may or may not be that skillful. And then we come to the Buddha, who also has his views. And it's important to understand that the Buddha offered the view of, excuse me, the Buddha's baseline, or the Buddha's foundation upon which he taught and investigated his life through practice was, is this suffering? Or does it lead to the end of suffering? That was the Buddha's concern, exclusively. And he said, that's what I teach. I teach suffering and the end of suffering. All the other ways of understanding experience, the Buddha put aside or put kind of upon this foundation of, does it lead to suffering? Does it lead to the end of suffering? And in the Buddha's first discourse, the first sharing of his realization with the five ascetics that he had practiced with before he became the Buddha, he taught and he told them about what he understood to be these universal truths, the four truths, the four noble truths, the four truths that if we have them in our life, ennoble us in our life as a human being. And the first, as many of you know, and I'm assuming that you all know this much Dharma, that you know, the first noble truth is the truth of dukkha. There's pain in life. There's insecurity in life. There's existential angst in life. Anybody that doesn't experience that? Kind of obvious, isn't it? But the second noble truth is that this dukkha, this pain, this angst, this insecurity, this instability is caused by clinging and craving. Holding on. Because we're looking for security in things, in people, in places, in stuff, in knowledge, and beliefs, and assumptions, and each other. And all of those things are changing out from underneath us all the time. And so the second noble truth is to just to see that because we hold on to things that are changing and don't stick around, we're going to feel insecure. We're going to suffer. We're going to be stressed and distressed. But the Buddha was thorough, if anything. And he said that even though there's a lot of dukkha in the world, and even though it's caused by a lot of clinging and hanging on to things that just can't provide the security we're looking for, relief is possible. This pain, this insecurity, this existential angst can come to an end. And it's for each one of us to realize that for ourselves. And the fourth noble truth is the path to be developed to realize this end of suffering. Now, I don't want to just give you a theoretical Dharma talk. You can read this in any book, any Dharma book of any significance. But I'm just asking you to consider in your own life how much you suffer. Fear, anxiety, insecurity, depression, jealousy, envy, anxiety. You know, it's not far. We don't have to look far to see that we suffer. You know, we've learned to it. You know, deal with it, we've adapted to it, we accept it, we acknowledge it, and we do what we can, but we're not free of it. The Buddha said you can be free of it. And the path to do that is this Noble Eightfold Path. The Noble Eightfold Path is essentially three trainings in mindfulness. Mindfulness. It's the training of purifying our speech and actions of selfish motivations. And if we purify our speech and action, meaning if we're not greedy and if we're not angry and if we're not just acting out of confused delusion, we can actually encourage harmonious relationships with each other. Now just think of that. Just think if your relationships, your personal, interpersonal, human relationships were less turmoiled, were just a little kinder, a little gentler, a little more understanding, a little less greedy, a little less angry, a little less judgmental, a little less demanding, that'd be a huge reduction in suffering in and of itself. But even though we might not be saying or doing what we're thinking, we still can be obsessed. And so the second training of the Noble Eightfold Path is a training of mindfulness of moment-to-moment experience. Again, it's mindfulness. It's not mindfulness of intentions before speaking and acting. It's mindfulness of what's obsessing your mind. What's going on in your mind? And as we begin to learn how to observe what's going on in the mind and all the obsessions that we get entangled in, addictions, compulsions, you know, just, you know, those habits of mind that just run without us, then we can begin to calm the mind down. We can begin to tame the mind. We can begin to soothe that feverish heat of the obsessed mind. Whatever obsession, whatever your particular flavor of obsession is. And this is what MBSR is very good at, is teaching us to let go of the obsessing, pay attention to the present moment. Really excellent. And just to get this glimpse of the tranquility or the seclusion of mind from these kinds of torments is exquisite. And it's the hook. It's what gets us hooked into the Dharma. And then the third training is the training in wisdom, which is being mindful or insightfully aware of what are called the three universal characteristics. And the three universal characteristics, as we all know, are impermanence, things change, dukkha, things are unpleasant or unsatisfactory, and the anatta characteristic, which things are conditioned, things have a life of their own, things are not under our immediate control. These are all experiences of the third characteristic. The benefit of realizing these three characteristics is peace. Peace. Peace of mind. Peace of heart. Not just tranquility, not just harmony, but peace. So what are the views that we need to hear to move beyond mindfulness as a calming technique for our pain and obsessed mind? What are the views that we need? Well, when Sariputta, second to the Buddha in wisdom, was asked this question by a group of monks, saying, how do we get this right view? How do we get these skillful views in our own heart? He said, there are two things that need to happen. You need to hear what the right view is. You need to hear the correct way of understanding. You need to hear a skillful way of understanding things. You have to hear it from somebody else first. Now, this is kind of a challenge to us all, because we're educated. Most of us are living here in the West, and we have opportunities to know and learn anything you want, and we're bright, and we've been taught through all our educational system to solve our own problems, and so we have a lot of confidence that we can solve our own problems. That if we don't know the answer, we can find the answer. We can get somebody that does know the answer, and we'll figure it out. And Sariputta said, you can do all that, but you can't figure this out. You can't figure out how to stop the mind from suffering. That is the exclusive purview of the Buddha. Here is someone who can look at what's going on in this mind and, well, figure it out for himself without anyone having pointed it out to him. Now, we might think, wait a minute, I'm not going to take anybody's word for this. And you don't have to take anybody's word for it. You just have to hear it. You don't have to believe it. You just have to hear it. Because if you hear the way things are from the Buddhist perspective, the way that leads to the end of suffering, is it suffering or does it lead to the end of suffering? If you hear it and practice with wise attention, this is the second element that's necessary to establish wise views in our heart. If we hear them and we practice with wise attention, we will recognize with wisdom how not to suffer. And this is the confirming empirical experienced reality of Third Noble Truth. We can see for ourselves the end of suffering is possible. The Buddha taught the Dharma. The Dharma is the way things are, or the way things have come to be. He didn't invent the Dharma. It's not a theory. It's not a good philosophy. It's not even a spiritual religion. It's a pointing to the way things are. And so when we read or hear or take in the Buddhist teachings, in some ways we should see that we should understand that it's pointing to the way things are. We may not understand it. We may not believe it. We may not want to believe it. But if we practice awareness, if we practice mindfulness, as the Buddha said in the Fourth Noble Truth, if we practice mindfulness, we will gradually refine our understanding and move into greater alignment with, well, the way things are. Because if we see for ourselves the way things have come to be, and we value not suffering, we will stop struggling with the way things are. We'll stop struggling, move into alignment, live in greater alignment with the way things are. Now, some people take this to mean that we should just be passive and accept everything as it is. That's not what the Buddha said at all. First, we need to see, oh, this is the way it is. This is how things have come to be. And this is how things have come to be. We understand the causes and conditions that lead to things being this way, and there's a tremendous amount of things that we don't like, that we think shouldn't be this way. There's a lot of suffering in the world that is avoidable. But avoidable human suffering, as Carl Sagan said, is more often called not so much by, is more often caused not so much by stupidity as by ignorance, especially of ourselves. Avoidable human misery, most often caused by ignorance of ourselves. So as we practice any of these trainings of the Noble Eightfold Path, we should understand that everything we experience and everything you experience in life, everything is natural. It's a natural process. It's nature. It's a natural function. There's no mistakes. There's nothing wrong with it. This is the way it is due to the law of cause and effect. The law of cause and effect says you bring these causes and conditions together, this is going to be the effect. So whatever effect you're experiencing, you may not understand the causes and conditions, and this can be a problem. But if we don't judge it as wrong or bad or unnatural, we have a willingness to look at it from the perspective of this is naturally arising due to causes and conditions. What are the causes and conditions that give rise to it? If I'm suffering with it, what's the problem? Where's it coming from? It's not that I'm a problem or I'm a mistake or I can't do it or it's unnatural. It's that we don't yet understand the causes and conditions. Mindfulness is to observe life in order to discover that. So, when we talk about mindfulness practice, which we're all doing, and which the Buddha encouraged in the Fourth Noble Truth, we should understand that in every moment, the mind is knowing something. Every moment. And a moment is a pretty short period of time. But without getting into defining just what that is, we know that we're always constantly just processing a tremendous amount of information. And yet when we try to be mindfully aware of what is going on moment to moment, we fail miserably, or at least I still am. You know, we sit down, and with all good intention, and following the simplest of instruction, remember to recognize your present moment's experience. That's all, that's it. Remember to recognize your present moment's experience. Did anybody succeed in doing that for 35 minutes? We don't. And why not? Well, because so much of the time, you might have noticed that the mind is off thinking, it's planning, it's remembering, it's commenting, it's rehearsing, it's doing all kinds of things that we don't know are happening at the time they happen. We're lost in thought. Now, isn't it amazing? We sit down with this intention, with this full intention, to follow this simple instruction. I can tell my young granddaughter, you know, what's happening? I just ask her, what's happening? She can tell me, and yet we can't do that. It's not difficult to understand, is it? But it's not easy to do. But isn't it amazing that we sit down with this intention to be aware, to be mindfully aware, to remember to recognize present moment's experience, and while we're lost in thought, we don't know we're lost in thought. We don't know what we're thinking about. We don't know if it's a good thing to be thinking about or a bad thing to think about. We don't know our gender. We don't know our age. We don't know our ethnicity. We don't know if we're sitting, we're standing, we're walking. We don't know. We don't know anything. This is called ignorance of ourself. And while we're busy missing out on all these moments of our very precious human life, we are reaffirming beliefs and assumptions and the stories that we've learned from our parents and our peers and our teachers and our government that we may not really agree with. But as long as we're not aware of them, we keep reaffirming them over and over and over again. So whenever you're lost in thought, you can be sure you're reaffirming the conditioning you have received. To me, that's amazing. It's amazing that we can be so lost when we have so much sincere intention to be awake. That's what we're up against. It's really powerful. The conditioning in this mind is extremely powerful. And it can't be taken lightly if we're going to aspire to realize the third noble truth, which is the end of suffering. One thing we learn with the very simplest of mindfulness instruction, if we can string together continuous moments of awareness, mindfulness of the breath, for example, breathing in, know that, breathing out, know that, breathing in, know that, breathing out, know that. If we can do that for a period of time, even a short period of time, the torments, the obsessions, the chatter of the mind, being lost in thought, stops. Stops. This is how we begin to stop feeding conditioning. So, when we're sad, for example, if we're just sad, we know what sad's like. We've all been sad. But sometimes we're not only lost in our sadness, sometimes we're thinking about it. We're thinking about, why am I sad? Well, I'm sad because. And then we explain it and we justify it. We recount the personal history that happened to make us sad. Mindfulness is something other than that. It's not being sad, and it's not thinking about sadness. Mindfulness is being aware that sadness has arisen in the mind. Not only sadness, but fear, anxiety, depression, joy, jealousy. So often, we experience life without awareness. I know that sounds like an oxymoron, but think about it. When we're sad and we're lost in the sadness, or when we're afraid and we're lost in the fear, we often don't know that fear is arisen in the mind, or sadness is arisen in the mind. We are so caught up in and identified with, I'm afraid, I'm sad, that we really don't see things clearly. So I want to point to this and say that being afraid, telling yourself the story of your fear, and being aware that fear has arisen in the mind are three very different experiences. Very different. But they all can only happen when fear is present. So it's important that we begin to understand, well, what's the difference between being afraid and being aware that fear has arisen in the mind? Wisdom. This is understanding. When you're afraid, if you were afraid and I said, are you afraid? You'd say, yeah, I'm afraid. But you're afraid, but without really knowing that fear is just an experience that has arisen in the mind. That kind of knowledge takes precise, continuous recognition of moment-to-moment experience. As we become aware of the obsessive states of mind as they arise, sadness when it arises, know that sadness has arisen. Fear when it arises, know that fear has arisen. Anxiety arises. Instead of being anxious, to be aware that anxiety has arisen in the mind. This is mindfulness. This is the mindfulness that leads to understanding. Because when we're caught in any of these states of mind, we don't see the roots of it. We just see that we want to get out of it. We just want to get rid of it. We don't want to be afraid. We don't want to be anxious. We don't want to be fearful. We want to get rid of it. But when we understand that, oh, this is an experience that's risen in the mind, we can look to see, well, what are the causes? What are the conditions? How is this happening? And then rather than just trying to get rid of that unpleasant, obsessive mental state, we can look at the conditions. We can understand the conditions. We can avoid those conditions in the future. But this takes understanding. And that understanding comes not from mindfulness. It comes from insight. It comes from practicing insight, which is, as Mahasi Sayadaw said, now Mahasi Sayadaw was one of the grandfathers of our tradition of mindfulness practice here in the West, a Burmese monk in the last century who taught mindfulness and insight meditation to lay people like ourselves. Meditation had been for monks and nuns living in monasteries and nunneries. But in 1949, he opened a meditation center in Rangoon for lay people, householders like ourselves. And with this, he was teaching them vipassana. He says, the practice of vipassana, insight, enables one to realize the ultimate nature of the body and the mind, to see their common characteristics of impermanence, suffering, and not self, and to realize the Four Noble Truths. This is what vipassana is for. Mindfulness is to remember to recognize the present moment. Vipassana is to understand the nature of the mind, the nature of the body, how they are talking to each other all the time, and to see their unique characteristic. You know, why do we have the word disappointment, and another word, frustration? You know, when we get into a situation where we feel that feeling, frustration is a very different feeling than disappointment. That's why we have two words, because there are two different experiences. But a lot of times, we don't know the difference experientially. We know the words, but the unique flavor of those mental states eludes us. We don't taste it for ourselves. We don't understand through our own experience the difference between frustration and disappointment. We can talk about them, but when we actually feel something in our heart, we may not recognize what it is. So I'd like to ask, do you know what a chico is? Do you know what a chico is? Anybody know what a chico is? Okay. So a chico is this fruit that grows in every Filipino's backyard in Hawaii. It's a fruit that's about the size of a kiwi. It's brown, like a kiwi. It's got a little smoother skin than a kiwi. And it's about the same size. And when you cut it open, inside the texture is like a perfectly ripe pear. Not too mushy, not mushy at all, but not too firm. It's not crunchy. It's just a firm mousse texture. And it has five seeds, about the size of a small almond, black and shiny. And when you scoop this, when you peel it or when you scoop the mousse, the kind of the cinnamon-colored mousse out of the skin, and you eat it, it is the most unbelievable sweet nectar taste you've ever tasted. It is just exquisite. You know what I mean? No, you don't, because you've never tasted it as a chico. You know, as much as you can hear the description and as much as you can imagine all you want to imagine, you don't know. You never had that experience. Isn't that amazing? We think we know. We think we know a lot, and we haven't really experienced it, like fear, anxiety, depression, sadness, loss, grief, happiness, joy, sorrow. We know those words. We have a general experience. But do we really know what they taste like? Really? We know the story of them. We've been taught the story, how to recognize what the story of sadness is. But do you know what the experience is? This is what Vipassana aims to really grok, to really get. That each experience of our life has its own unique flavor. Some of it's pleasant. And some of it's unpleasant. Some of it's the chicos of life, and some of it is the durians of life, or some other unripe fruit, maybe, like that. And so we have pleasant and unpleasant experiences, and of course we avoid the unpleasant ones as much as possible. Like we don't even want to know what that is really, and the pleasant ones we just want to indulge in so much that we just get our tastes get cloyed, and we just don't understand. We don't really taste them anymore. You know, did you ever overeat, you know, something you really liked? You know, the first bite, delicious. Second bite, 80% delicious. Third bite, 50% delicious. After that, it's terrible. Right? So the practice of Vipassana enables one to realize the ultimate nature of the body, the ultimate nature of the mind, and to see their common characteristics, which are impermanence, suffering or unsatisfactoriness in non-self. Do you know that things change? Do you know that things change? We know that things change. I mean, if you ask anybody, do you know that things change? They think, are you stupid? Of course I know that things change. Or you ask somebody walking down the street, you know, you find somebody walking down the street here in Seattle, you say, do you know you're walking down the street? They'd look at you like you were a nut. But actually, they don't know they're walking down the street. They don't know the experience of walking down the street. They're thinking of the past or what they see in the window, or they're thinking about, you know, something they got to do at work or something that somebody said, or they're planning or, you know, and they're not really aware of the experience of walking down the street. We live our life like that a lot. We're not really present for it. Vipassana practice asks us to be present for the experience of walking down the street, tasting the chico, tasting the durian, the durians of life. So, in our conditioning that we've learned from our family and friends and peers, as I said, we gravitate towards those things that are pleasant, and we try to avoid those things that are unpleasant. And so when we practice mindfulness and we practice insight, we're going to inevitably come upon experiences which are pleasant, yay, and experiences which are unpleasant, yay. That didn't sound right. Wait a minute. Because Even in meditation, we often evaluate our practice by the quality of pleasantness or unpleasantness. And that is not the judge. That's not the parameter with which to evaluate the effectiveness or the purpose or the value of your practice. Because life offers both. And if we're picking and choosing and trying to only have good experiences and not wanting to have bad experiences, we're struggling. Struggling. And so what attitude of mind is necessary as we practice to see through that wrong belief that we learned from our parents and our peers and our government? It's a wrong belief that pleasant is better, unpleasant is worse. We all have that belief, right? I'm not the only one that had that belief. I know. You know, we all have that belief. That's a wrong belief. That's going to cause you a tremendous amount of suffering. And it does, doesn't it? But what we don't realize until you go on a meditation retreat, one of our students says, you know, nothing like a good sitting ruin the rest of your day. You know why? Because you have a good sitting, you know, it's kind of calm, you're still, it's subtle, it's pleasant, and you think. You can't help but think. It's not like you really believe it. It's not like somebody's saying, do you really believe this? But you have the assumption, now I got it. Good sitting? This is the way it's going to be for the rest of the day. Huh? And it isn't. You know? So that good sitting ruins your rest of your day. Because we have this belief, we have these wrong assumptions, we have these wrong beliefs about pleasant, unpleasant. We don't understand. We don't see things as they are. Vipassana is to see things as they are. So the understanding, the attitude that we need to bring to our practice is one of interest. Being interested in everything equally. Think about that. Being as interested in the most painful, unpleasant experiences of your life as you are in the most joyful, happy, pleasant moments of your life. That's going to take some work, frankly. Now, in all honesty, it takes some work to be as interested in the unpleasant as the pleasant. How do we change that wrong understanding? That's just one of them. That's just one of them. The understanding that, oh, this is going to last forever. You know, you get these kinds of experiences, whether it's a good sitting or falling in love, or you have a bad experience, you get depressed or you get fearful, and you think, you don't think. The assumption in the mind is, this is the way it's going to be. You know, we know it isn't. You know, if anybody asked us, we wouldn't say, we don't believe that, but it feels that way. It feels that way. You know, however you're feeling, you feel like this is the way it's going to be. If it's difficult and challenging and frustrating, you can't help but think, God, this is the way it's going to be. You might cognitively reframe it and say, hey, this is bad thinking. Every time I think like this, I got to remember, no, that's not true. And you can cognitively reframe it, but the assumption, the unexamined assumption of it, is still embedded in the mind. How are you going to get that? How are you going to get to that unexamined assumption or those beliefs that you have kind of inherited from your parents? So Mark Epstein, one of our colleagues on the interface, you know, writing on the interface between mindfulness in Dharma and psychotherapy or psychoanalysis, he has written, as the Buddhist view has consistently demonstrated, it is the perspective of the one who suffers that determines whether a given experience perpetuates suffering or is a vehicle for awakening. To work something through
means to change one's view. If we try instead to just change our emotional relation or reaction to something, we may achieve some short-term success, but we remain bound by the forces of attachment and an aversion to the very feelings which we're struggling to be free. Well, let me put this in English. What this means is, you know, when we find a situation in life provoking anger, irritation, you know, you don't have to stop and think about how to be angry, how to be irritated. Man, it comes just like that, right? You don't have to give it a thought. It's just so deeply conditioned to react with aversion of anger or irritation that, okay, this is a belief we have. It's embedded within us. The idea that anger or irritation is a good thing to do in this situation. We've learned this. We've learned it. And clearly, it's not a good thing to do. I mean, we know anger and irritation is rarely a skillful response. But we get caught, don't we? So there's, inside of us, there's this belief, this assumption, and this conditioning that just kicks it up immediately. Now, with mindfulness practice, we can see, oh, anger has arisen. And we have all been taught loving kindness. We can say, ah, I know what to do with anger. Loving kindness, oh, may I be free of anger. May I be free of this suffering. May you be free of my suffering. May you be free of your own suffering. And we can do loving kindness to the ourselves. We can do loving kindness to the perpetrator of whatever act caused us to be angry. You know, we're not blaming them, we're just sending them metta, loving kindness. And if you're good at it, you can soothe that anger. You can soothe that irritation. You can calm it right down and just have real loving thoughts towards yourself, a loving thoughts towards the other person. But what we've done actually is we have kind of suppressed the belief, that view, that belief, that assumption in the mind. And we replaced it with loving kindness. Now, this is a good thing to know how to do. I'm not saying loving kindness is not something to do. By all means, do it all you want. But the roots of anger and irritation are still in the mind. They haven't been uprooted. They've been kind of suppressed. Vipassana practice, that's what mindfulness will do. Vipassana practice says, okay, anger has arisen. I want to learn the nature of anger. I want to learn the causes and conditions that give rise to anger. And so to do that, Vipassana practice doesn't resort to metta. Vipassana practice stays with the experience of the anger to learn its nature. Well, not only anger, anxiety, fear, jealousy, stress, everything that causes you to have an aversive reaction, or to have some tormented, obsessive reaction that causes you suffering. Vipassana practice wants to understand them, wants to learn about them through observing, not through thinking about, not through reading a book, not through trying to figure it out, not trying to get rid of it. You can get rid of it. You can get rid of any of those obsessive things anytime you want. Just go to the refrigerator and stuff yourself. You'll get rid of it temporarily. But you don't learn anything. You still have the tendency, you still have the belief in the mind that kind of, when it comes up, you act on it. Vipassana practice changes those beliefs. Changes them. Because we see, we look into, well, what happened here in this angry reaction, this impatient reaction, this fearful reaction, this anxious, whatever it is. What happened? What sense of yourself got constellated? Why are we so attached to that sense of self? How did it happen? What do we believe about ourselves that fear, anxiety, stress of one sort or another is a right and skillful response to the situation? It never is. And yet we believe it. How are we going to get to those beliefs? How are we going to get down into the mind that far? Not by thinking, not even by mindfulness, but through insight, vipassana. through staying with the unfolding of each of these states of mind, so that you really see all the pixels of phenomena, all the pain, all the memories, all the plans, all the sensations in the body, all the feelings in the heart, all the stories you've told yourself that justified being angry. You have to see them with this interested mind, this mind that's really interested not to judge, not to pick and choose, not to approve or anything, just to see this is the nature of this mental state. This is how it behaves, or I should say this is how it misbehaves. And only then will we begin to see its true nature. And the interesting thing that happens as we practice insight and in the nature, the very essence of Vipassana is to realize the three characteristics. Now I say to realize meaning not to think about, oh, this is impermanent. That's thinking. But to realize from your own observation, you're observing these mental states, you're observing this suffering, you're observing the sense of self that kind of gets constellated with fear, anxiety, and this takes a tremendous willingness, frankly. It takes a tremendous willingness to feel pain, feel suffering, feel anxiety, feel them with full awareness. Feel into them. Not run away, not suppress, not trying to fix it, not trying to explain it, but just feel it. Feel with your mind. And when you feel, when you directly feel into these experiences, what do you learn? One thing you learn is, this is really unsatisfactory. You know, even desire. You know, when we're caught and inflamed in desire and we think, yeah, I want that. I want that experience. I want that new thing in the catalog that I've never needed for the last 50 years, but now I do. I want that new car. I want this knowledge. I want this experience. I want that person. I want whatever. You know, when you get inflamed with desire, you feel very excited and pleasant, and it's really pleasant because we're paying attention to the object. The object of desire is always pleasant. Did you notice that? Did you ever desire unpleasant objects? No, you don't desire. No, that's not the nature of desire. The nature of desire is it causes you to see only the pleasant aspect of something. That's the nature of desire. You can't desire unpleasant things. You desire pleasant things. So when we're paying attention to desire, we think, oh, this is pleasant, meaning the object's pleasant. But if we turn around and we look at the and feel into the feeling of desire itself, unfulfilled desire, you know what that's like. That's not pleasant. But what we realize is this is unsatisfactory, and not only is it unsatisfactory, so what? It's unsatisfactory. Is that okay? It's not okay to the one who feels unsatisfied, but awareness, mindfulness, is not you. It's a quality, it's a capacity of the mind that can be trained. We can train the mind can be trained, but it's not ours. So as we train the mind to willingly feel into the nature of these, well, you know, suffering, obsessions, suffering. We recognize they're not satisfactory, all of them. We also recognize they're out of control, that we can't control them. We can't stop them, you know, other than diverting ourselves, distracting ourselves. We don't make them happen. We don't invite them to happen. They just happen. This is the anatta characteristic. It's impersonal. You know, you don't have to do anything wrong and it'll still happen. When you realize this, not just think it. Thinking is not realization. But when you get it, when you're experiencing something deeply, intimately, like that, you realize this is out of control. This is happening on its own conditions, causes and conditions. That is a liberating insight. Just as when we realize, this is really unsatisfactory. When something is really unsatisfactory, do you have to struggle to let go of it? The mind goes, I don't want this. You know, whether it's, you know, you get some food on your plate and it's not what you wanted, you don't have to, you just, I'm not going to eat that. The mind doesn't have to struggle to let go of what's unsatisfactory. The mind doesn't have to struggle to let go of what is not under its control. We also learn, we realize, it doesn't last very long. If we can actually steady our attention on the experience, on this really unpleasant, out of control experience, this unsatisfying experience, we will see, we'll realize, we'll come to this understanding, it doesn't last. It's impermanent. Now, when Vipassana insights of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and the conditional nature of things, when those insights are ripe, mature, then we see these characteristics of every experience. Every experience. You know the taste of it, that's its unique flavor, and you know its common characteristics, or its universal characteristics. It doesn't last very long, it's really unsatisfying. It's unsatisfying. It arises due to causes and conditions, and it'll leave in its own good time. When the mind has these understandings through realization, not through thinking, not through a book, but through your own experience, empirical experience, the mind does not reach for and hold on to anything. This is called equanimity. Not because we're trying to have a balanced relationship to things, but because the mind sees, this is not worth grabbing, this is not worth holding on to, this is not worth clinging to, and that's the second noble truth. You know, the second noble truth is the cause of suffering is craving, clinging, holding on. And so when the mind sees that, over and over again, every moment it just sees these three characteristics. This is painful, this is suffering, this is impermanent, this is not under my control. The mind doesn't reach for anything. The mind is really balanced. The mind is really equanimous. Things become really subtle. You don't even pick up the idea in your mind, let alone in your hand. The mind doesn't pick it up, even. It doesn't even hold the concept of any of these experiences, or even the concept of oneself. Things get really subtle. It is at this time and this time only that the mind can fall into the unconditioned. It's at this time, from this state of mind, that the mind can fall into the unconditioned. The unconditioned isn't caused by anything. It has no taste, no flavor, no size, shape, color, anything. The unconditioned is nibbana. It is a reality that can be realized. When the mind doesn't need to let go, it doesn't reach for anything. Only then can it fall into the unconditioned. Nibbana is the non-arising of conditioned phenomena, mental and physical. Conditioned phenomena doesn't arise anymore. It is the cessation of any object to be noted, to be noticed. And it has the unique characteristic of peacefulness. Not just harmony, not just tranquility, not joy, not just this clear light of pure awareness. It's peaceful. And the Buddha said of Nibbana, the unconditioned, it is deep. Hard to see, hard to understand. It is peaceful. It is sublime. It is beyond mere reasoning, like that chico. It is subtle, and it is available or accessible to the wise. And the Buddha concluded his teachings by saying, the purpose of my teaching, of all of these practices of the holy life, the Dhamma, is not for gaining merit, nor is it for doing good deeds, nor is it for rapture and bliss, nor is it for concentration or samadhi, tranquility, but it is for this sure heart's release. When the heart can release all this, this and this alone is the reason for the teachings of the Buddha. This is the reason for the teachings of the Buddha. All these other things, they come. Spiritual goodies, all kinds of them, lots. They're kind of like nourishment on the way, but they're not the journey, they're not the goal. The purpose of my teaching of the holy life of the Dharma is for the sure heart's release, meaning the heart, the mind, lets go of everything and stop suffering. Peaceful, peaceful. You know, sometimes when we hear the teaching of the Buddha, we hear about Nibbana, we think, that's too far away. That's good for people that lived at the time of the Buddha. Or maybe there's people who can be monks or nuns or live in a cave for 20 or 30 years or whatever. And we think, that's not for me. We don't even imagine it's possible to realize. We miss it. We miss the opportunity. We miss the availability of Nibbana in this lifetime. It's not so far away. Don't be satisfied with MBSR 1.0. Go to 2.0. MBSR 2.0 or more. There's so much more that can be realized with mindfulness. Peacefulness. Possible. So, thank you for listening. So if there's any questions or a little bit of time or comments, maybe you've got comments, questions, disbeliefs, assumptions, challenges, frustrations, disappointments. Yes.
In looking at my feelings, trying to understand them from both a psychological viewpoint, you know, in terms of understanding the roots and the causes and conditions that led to my anger. How do I sort of differentiate, and maybe it doesn't matter, I certainly think it doesn't, but the psychological versus the, for lack of a better word, spiritual, you know,
sure.
I'm pretty into this stuff, and pretty, you know,
sure. Of course. So the question is, you know, today there was a very angry reaction to something that someone wrote in an email, and in looking at the psychological, you know, kind of how this all happened, you know, the question is, well, what's different between that, or how do I go from there to the spiritual, or, you know, where does Vipassana come into this? And I think the best way of understanding it is to say, you know, when we see the tip of the iceberg of a kind of a emotional storm, you know, it presents itself as just, you know, we're upset with, you know, some heavy emotional drama. And the immediate obvious surface of it is, they said this, I said that, I shouldn't have done this, I feel like crap, I'd like to punch him out, you know, and that's a story. So that's one thing that's got to be noticed. But as you notice that, and you notice the sensations that are occurring in the body, and you notice all your reactions, and you just, again, with mindful awareness, which is just interested in everything, it's not trying to fix it, it's not trying to get rid of the anger, it's trying to understand the anger. Okay, so what is it to understand? Well, you need to understand the story. You need to understand these are the physical sensations that are so unpleasant, conditioned by the mind. You need to understand, oh, this is what it feels like, what anger feels like in the heart, without the story. You know, put the story over here, put the sensations over there. What's that anger feel like in the heart? And as you kind of pour the solvent of mindfulness on this psychophysical knot of anger, you begin to dissolve the glue that holds it all together. And the glue that holds it all together is the identification with, this is me, this is mine, this is my story, my anger, this is happening to me. And that glue is really tough. Because we take on everything that happens without seeing that it's an impersonal causes and conditions giving rise to this stuff. But as you pour the mindfulness, meaning as you observe mindfully everything that comes up, as you're trying to observe this, the story, the sensations, the feelings, the plans for revenge, the other incidences similar to this in your life, this whole thing, the glue of identification loosens and you get the exploded view, so to speak, the pixelated view, I call it, of psychophysical knot. Right? It's still in the rough shape. It's all there, but you see it all as just pixels of phenomena. There's, you know, little pieces of memory and judgments and fears and joys, sorrows and stories and sensations in the body and, you know, self-judgments about yourself for being angry and, you know, all that is in there. And the more you are mindful, the more you get this exploded view, the pixelated view of it, and the less solid it feels like, I'm so angry, and I'm justified in being angry. We see, oh, anger has arisen due to these causes and conditions, and, you know, the 100,000 times in my life which has happened before. Okay, you know, okay, we understand. We begin to understand. Who is it that gets angry? You know, just getting rid of anger is not the problem. It's like, who is it that's angry? Who got constellated by that email? What sense of yourself came into being? And why are you still holding on to it? This is a story you've been telling yourself for, you know, since, you know, this afternoon. I'm so angry because, as long as that story's kind of got a grip in the mind, then you'll be angry, you'll suffer. But as you get mindful and you watch it all dissolve and kind of open up, then you can see, there's just stuff happening. If I identify with it, I got a psychophysical knot, right? And if I'm mindful of it, it's just like pixels of phenomena floating through time and space. There's no difference, really, between the what you call you know, psychological or the spiritual. Don't make that distinction. It's just stuff. Something we get identified with. Whatever we get identified with is going to cause suffering. Yeah, Peter.
So you talked about sort of metta and vipassana and the difference. Can you talk, and I know the talk you're giving is focused more on
Vipassana.
The value of vipassana. But can you talk a little bit about the role of the two?
Sure.
And how they maybe support each other?
Sure. Yeah. I did say, you know, you could practice metta, and it's good to know how to do metta. It's good to know how to do loving kindness for yourself, for others, when anger and aversion, you know, upset, impatience, and then anything arises. But what it does is, what Vipassana does that's different is Vipassana seeks to understand the nature of aversion. Now, the reason to do the metta is because you're caught in the anger, you're caught in the impatience, you're caught in the, and you need to chill, you need to kind of calm it down before you can look at it. So when it's overwhelming, when anger is overwhelming, any form of aversion is overwhelming, then use the metta, of course. Calm down a little bit. Just kind of get so you get to where you can actually be with, you know, the froth of the anger. Okay, so then when you can be with it, then really observe in order to learn. Not to get rid of, not to explain, not to justify, but to observe, to learn its nature, the nature of anger. So this is where metta, in this case, or antidotes, any kind of antidote to any of these obsessions is skillful. When it's overwhelming, use it. when it's not overwhelming, or when you can be with it, then turn your attention, do the Vipassana practice with it. Really learn by observing with interest. So, you know, and let's face it, you have a lot of suffering. You know, and doing loving kindness for yourself soothes that suffering. You know, because, you know, the path of Vipassana practice brings you close to dukkha, understanding dukkha. The first noble truth, the truth of dukkha, is to be understood, to be investigated and understood. So we're going to experience a lot of dukkha in this path of Vipassana. But that doesn't mean that, you know, you're not doing it right. That this is the very essence of the Vipassana practice, is to really come to understand the fullness of this first noble truth. But as a relief, while you're on the journey, take metta along with you. Yeah, no. Don't go without your metta. Take that with you. Yes. Is that what you, you know, that addresses what you're asking? Yeah, one more. You know, we do feel very confident. We do feel like we have new ways of understanding. And let's face it, now the Buddha's teachings, whether you hear it directly from a Buddhist teacher or read it, you know, is pretty widespread. And so a lot of what we're getting from other directions is actually Buddhist understanding. So, you know, you may be getting ideas and understandings and whatnot from other sources, which doesn't feel like it's the Buddha's teachings or Dharma teachings, but it may actually be influenced that way. So the primary view that the Buddha came to realize is all this that's happening here in this thing called my human life is not happening to anyone. It's not, there's no person in here to whom it's happening. This is a conjunction of conditions that are arising and passing away moment to moment, and there's no inherent enduring entity here called Steve. The little Steve that's somewhere in here. No such thing. There's just causes and conditions arising that we get identified with. You know, that's the primary insight that the Buddha is pointing to. That all of this suffering is because we think it's happening to me. It's mine, it's my fear, my anxiety, my body, me. And actually, that's a wrong understanding. Which, if we look carefully, if we hear that, we might say, what the hell is he talking about? That's ridiculous, that doesn't make any sense. I know it's me, of course. Come on, what are you talking about? That doesn't make sense. But you just hear it and you say, well, I don't know if I believe that. You don't have to believe it. Don't believe it. Just do the practice. If you do the practice, you'll come to see in various ways that it may be true. After all, don't you believe that the sun circles the earth? You know, goes around the earth every day? You don't believe that. But your direct perception to see the sun rise over there in the east, go overhead and set in the west every day, a few hours later it rises in the east, goes overhead and sets in the west. Your direct perception is the sun is going around the earth. You can't understand it any other way. And yet you have been told by your teachers, by your parents, by all kinds of people, that no, the sun isn't going around the earth. The earth is spinning on its axis, creating the effect of day and night. And in fact, it's the earth that goes around the sun, taking a year to do it. And you believe that now, right? Even though you've never been able to confirm it through your own direct experience. But you were told the right way of understanding this is, oh, the earth spins on its axis, creating day and night. So you no longer believe what you directly experience. So now I'm telling you, all that's happening in that sitting on that cushion right there, that feels like me, my body, my mind, my heart, my emotions, it's not you. There's no you in there. Generally speaking, yeah, there's a you, and I honor the divine within you. And if you look closely, you'll see, wow, there's forces at play in here that you don't know where they came from. It's not you. It's not yours. You can't control it. You can train the mind, but man, so much of it's out of your control. Keep practicing. If you look, you'll see. Don't believe me, but don't neglect your practice either. Thank you all.